The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
I think that this is a business. There are those who are not just in Uganda, but various different countries in Africa and in India too, who have realized that there is big money in convincing people that sacrificing a child will make them rich. Children are murdered for money.
Today is really quite an impactful and emotional episode, so I do warn you that we talk about some really gruesome things, and it's up to you whether you want to hear about that on this fine sunny day or grisly grey day or night or wherever you are, however it is. Annie Ikpa is a hero to me because she fought to end child sacrifice in Uganda. That's what we're talking about today. I didn't know the practice even took place until I stumbled upon Annie's work and invited her on the podcast. For various reasons, it ended up taking a few months to get this out there, but it's such an important subject that I really did want to cover it, and I'm glad that I've managed to get this out on the podcast. Annie is a freelance TV editor, and she was the instigator of the bill to change things in Uganda after having experiences there that alerted her to the way that families and certain rogue individuals were going about sacrificing children. Go to childrenontheedge.org to read more about the inside story of their five-year fight, 7 years for Annie in total, to change the law. Annie Ikpa is a wonderful speaker, very passionate about her work, and she's been a joy to work with. You can watch a video she did about this subject on Lad Bible's YouTube channel as well. Episodes are coming up on the podcast with Holly Laurent to talk about her film work and life growing up evangelical, the second part to the Robbie Williams episode, and an interview with Australian female psychopath Kanika Batra. But now, you're on the edge of child sacrifice in Uganda with Annie Ikpa. Hi, welcome on the edge, Annie Ikpa. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Very, very happy to be here, finally.
Yeah, we've been trying for a while, haven't we? It's really nice to get you here, and your equipment's great. Everything's great. I'm very happy. Tell me a bit about your background and the productions you've worked on over the years.
Yeah, so I am a freelance video editor. I work mainly in sort of reality, entertainment, I think what most people call trash TV, I guess.
Love it.
But I love it. Love Island, I've worked on Strictly, Come Dancing, I'm a Celeb, Get Me Out of Here, Made in Chelsea, TOWIE, Too Hot to Handle, just finished that was really good. So yeah, I work on a broad range of shows, but all seemingly in the same sort of genre. But I very much enjoy my job, yeah.
In general, how much do you sort of push them around? Let's say Love Island, how much are they sort of pushed to have certain conversations?
Obviously not going to answer that. I mean, they aren't. It's reality. It's sort of, you know, obviously within the spectrum of, you know, it's a television show, right? So being very, very careful not to say something that's going to make sure I'm never hired again. It's unscripted. It really is unscripted. I think there's like this massive misconception that Made in Chelsea, The Only Way Is Essex, they're given this kind of script before they're filmed, and they are not. They really are not.
Fair enough. And you're right. I don't want to prod you on that because I don't want to get you in trouble.
Moving on. Yeah.
Yeah, moving on. But this is the thing. So, I mean, it's fairly reality show, fairly superficial, but a lot of us love it, and I enjoy watching it myself. And you do learn a bit about society and things. But how did you get involved in the kind of activism that you've been doing that we're going to talk about today?
Do you know what? There's this thing about the word activism that just sounds a bit like, I want to say poncy, but I don't. It sounds like activism is kind of like saved for the middle class, really posh, loaded kids who are rebelling against their really loaded parents. And I'm just not that at all. So I would not consider myself an activist. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, it's not that at all.
We need another word.
We need, yeah. I don't know. What would you suggest?
Impactful stuff.
I don't know. I think I think it got to a point where I was working and, you know, enjoying my job, but feeling a little bit kind of like, there could be something else kind of out there. And I wanted a bit of a change. And I reached out to a lady who ran a baby's home in Uganda. And she sort of looked for and needed TV people to go over there and shoot films and edit them and stuff. And I very quickly agreed and, you know, went to Uganda. I think it was only supposed to be about 3 months, and I ended up staying 6 or 7 in the first instance. And at this baby's home, which is a little bit like, it's somewhere in between a baby's home and a rescue center. There are children there from the ages of like 0 to 11, 12, who have been sort of either found abandoned or rescued from their homes, brought to this baby's home, and, you know, they try and basically find Ugandan families to adopt these kids. And there was one girl there who had, I was told, survived child sacrifice. And yeah, it was through her and the organization that I learnt quite a lot about what this practice is and the effects it's had on the country.
Was that a shock for you to learn about? I mean, did you know that that existed?
Not specifically child sacrifice. I knew that, you know, there was such things as the occult, and I knew about witchcraft through my dad, who's Nigerian, but I hadn't ever heard about like sacrifice. And obviously, like, there are sacrifices that are made, but it's always to do with animals and chickens and goats, which is very, very common, but never had I heard of humans being sacrificed, and certainly not children.
Yeah, it's really quite unnerving and scary. I thought the same as you, and I thought it was maybe like, I don't know, an old wives' tale, or maybe even like a xenophobic thing about, oh, these other countries where that happens. I suppose is it embarrassing for a lot of people from those countries that this goes on? Are people in these countries, in the cities, are they aware of this happening?
Do you know what? I wouldn't say embarrassed. I think there's obviously a lot of shame, right? There's a lot of shame. I think people do realize it's happening. You can't not. However, it's not so much a taboo subject, right? People aren't open about it unless you really ask the questions. And I found when I heard about this and I went researching, people were really kind of hesitant at first to talk about it, but it only took a little bit of digging and scratching the surface. And they would just unearth all of these awful stories that they were so obviously keen to talk about and needed for themselves, you know, to explain to someone, even though I was a foreigner, what was happening in their country. Because it felt to me as though they'd never been asked, yet they really wanted to communicate this horror that was happening all around them. So do people know about it? Yes. People are willing to talk about it, but you just got to ask the questions and ask the right questions.
Is it a horror for everyone? Because I guess some of these people are carrying out the practice. So for those people, did you speak to any of those people, and were they sort of defending the practice?
No, of course, like, no one would outright come out and say that they had. However, I made like a little documentary about it, as much for me really to sort of help document what I was hearing, but also because at one point I wanted to take it to the government and just say, look, this is what's happening. And I met, you know, survivors of child sacrifice. I met parents who'd lost their children. I interviewed the police, the judiciary, but I also interviewed this witch doctor who had very recently given up the practice. I didn't and could not ask him outright if he had, you know, was involved in sacrificing children, but there was an air about him that he had done things that he was not proud of. So, yeah, I kind of got close. I met this one woman. In fact, yes, I met this one woman. I won't say where. And she did actually admit to sacrificing children. I had completely forgotten about this. I was not actually traveling. I wasn't actually specifically working on this side of, you know, on researching child sacrifice at all. I met her completely by chance. And I got talking about what I was doing. And she said that her family had forced her, introduced her to the occult, and she had been sort of born into this idea that, you know, when you sacrifice children, it will lead to riches and prosperity. And she was forced to carry out these things, and she was deeply, deeply ashamed. The conversation couldn't have lasted more than 5 minutes. And she was just desperate to get out of her situation. I don't know if she was continuing, you know, if she was still doing it then, but it's so weird. I'd completely forgotten about that. And it's something that I wish I'd remembered a long time ago, because, yeah, I don't know, perhaps I could have, I probably would have behaved a bit differently. I don't know, weirdly.
How so?
Well, I was so wrapped up in like just trying to sort of get the message out there that this exists. But actually, weirdly, there are people who clearly are involved in this who are desperate to get out. It probably wasn't a fight that I was able to take on at the time. But in hindsight, I wish I paid a bit more attention to that. And there's no way in hell I'll be able to find her now.
Yeah, well, hindsight, it's one of those things as a journalist, isn't it? It's impossible. There's so many leads, aren't there? And you just can't possibly remember all of them, and, you know.
Yeah.
You spoke of parents, you know, losing their children. I mean, so would is it often that one sacrifices one's own children, or that they're sort of taken from the parents?
Both. So children, it's easier to sacrifice your own children for accessibility reasons. And also there is a myth that when you sacrifice your own child, your own blood, it's whatever you're trying to do is more likely to work, because it's a, you know, effectively a bigger sacrifice. But more often than not, children are abducted on their way to school, or when they're sort of working in the fields, especially. So either one of those.
It must be terrifying for the families. But I mean, we do a lot on this podcast. I'm always talking about, you know, cults and extreme ideologies, and that, you know, the banality of evil, how these beliefs can make even good people do awful, awful things. Do you think these people, when they're sacrificing their children, I mean, they must, firstly, they really believe that it's going to bring good things. Do you know of any beliefs they have about the child itself? Like, okay, now my child's going to go to heaven?
No, and I haven't ever heard of that, no. No, why? Have you?
No, it's just because it's so difficult to imagine a parent sacrificing their own child without, unless there was a reason, like, okay, but they're going to go to heaven, so it's okay.
Well, I can tell you why. I think it's really easy to point the finger and say, you're so fucking evil, you've done this to your child, and absolutely, I am not condoning it one bit. But there are, you know, there's two ends of this spectrum here. You've got the rich people who are sacrificing children to kind of maintain their wealth. And then you've got the really, really poor, impoverished, desperate people who are sacrificing children, their own children, to emerge from that poverty because they genuinely feel as though there is no other way. They've been brainwashed by their community, brainwashed by the witch doctor that they're consulting. So they absolutely genuinely believe that this will help them emerge from their poverty.
Do you get the impression that even it's a really hard decision for them to make?
Naturally, yeah.
And so I suppose it's a difficult question, but I mean, do you have an impression of how they typically go about sacrificing children?
They abduct the child, they obtain the child, and often they use chloroform to knock the child out, but they sacrifice the child, i.e. remove organs and cut the child and take what they need, often while the child is alive and conscious. So whether they, and chloroform is not readily available in Uganda. So yeah, children are held down, you know, you can imagine it. And, you know, it's obviously incredibly harrowing because there are those who have survived and can tell you what happened to them. They remember the pain and they remember and can identify the perpetrators and their attackers. So what normally happens is that they they take what they need from the child. And it's not normally the witch doctor who does this, who does the cutting. It's someone that they have employed. And then they then go back to the witch doctor with the body parts, and they are mixed in with ritual medicine by the witch doctor. And, you know, a ritual is made to the ancestors who have demanded this, and yeah, that's the general kind of process.
What did it make you feel like learning about this for the first time?
Dirty. Like the fact that I'd been like blissfully walking around and living my life and not having a clue that this happened all at the time. I just felt really ashamed. And I think maybe that's why I just put so much of myself into doing anything that I could to make some sort of difference and impact. Because I just felt so much guilt, weirdly. And also I had this, you know, I was completely inspired by this little girl, and felt that I just had this kind of real kinship to her. I was seeing her every day, and I just wanted to do her proud and do every other child proud who had suffered at the hands of this practice.
And this was a survivor. What was her story?
So when sacrifices are often made during election times to help bring good luck, you'll often find the bodies of children under construction sites to bless a building, mall, apartment building. And this little girl had been taken to a construction site. A witch doctor had laid her down and just sprinkled herbs all around her and all over her body. And luckily a security guard had seen what was going on, stopped it, and called the baby's home where I was working. She was brought to the baby's home. But she, I think, was one of the cases where it was the parents who had ordered that, because there was a nationwide appeal for her parents does anybody know this girl? Her picture was everywhere, all over the news and newspapers, and nobody came forward. And we suspected that her parents could have been involved in that. But she was, it was awful. She was really quite a shell of a human being when I met her. She was just terrified and visibly traumatized. And, you know, I just loved her instantly. And I just wanted to learn about the practice that nearly killed her. And yeah, we just got really, really close. And I'm still in touch with her now.
Did she start to recover upon being with you and back to sort of normal life?
Yeah, she did. Yeah, very like gradually.
What's she up to now?
So she's now living with a teacher who's fantastic. She's got two brothers living in a really nice house in a village, surrounded by like pigs and chicken and mango trees. She's flourishing. I'm going to see her next month.
Oh, wow. She must love you, though. She must like see you as, I mean, how old is she now?
Well, we think that she was like, obviously she didn't come with like documentation, right? But we think that she's probably about 10 now or 9. She just makes it out every year. She's like, oh, I think I'm 7, I'm 8, I'm 9. Because her, yeah. but her birthday's the 1st of July. So I think her parents picked that as it's, easy, middle of the year.
And I suppose that security guard saved her life as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And like about a year after, I sort of started digging around and wanted to learn a bit more about her case. And I went to the police station where the case was reported, and they had lost the case files. So I couldn't, there's nothing exists on who found her or anything, because that's what I wanted to do next.
What do you think that might mean, that they've lost them?
I think it can mean lots of things. Lots of cases go missing. to be honest with you, I can't say, and I wouldn't like to speculate.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com. For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
What's Kampala like? And is that where this is mostly going on, or is it the rest of Uganda?
It happens all over, normally in the villages. There's particular districts where it's particularly prevalent, but it also happens in Kampala. But on the whole, Kampala is a wonderful, wonderful city. When I first got there, I just instantly felt at home. Like, the people are genuinely the nicest people, the most welcoming. And I think that was really important doing the kind of work that I was doing, that I felt like I had a second home in a way. And I felt for the most part safe there. But it's really cool. The nightlife is amazing. Really good. There are amazing restaurants. You should go. I think you'd enjoy it. We can party there together.
I'd love to. Oh yeah. Oh, I would love that.
It's honestly, it's so good.
There's so many places to see. I've only ever been to South Africa in Africa. I did a rugby tour when I was younger, but that was beautiful. What a beautiful country. I suppose every country's beautiful, isn't it? I don't know that there's a country that's not beautiful.
I don't think I've been to enough places to answer that, do you know?
But everyone must have its beauty.
Yeah, exactly. And Kampala, Uganda has it in abundance, really. It's absolutely stunning. And I've just, felt like I had really understood the rhythm of the country. I'd been there on and off for nearly 8 years. And my dad, who's Nigerian, he probably wouldn't like to hear this, but I feel more Ugandan than I do Nigerian.
Don't tell him that.
I know. No, let's keep that between us. Even though the bill's like passed, it's now a law, I just can't help but go back. And obviously I'm still involved, not as much as I was, but there's just something about that country that just keeps pulling me back.
I want to go with you there, but it's just expensive probably, isn't it?
Not really. Get on Skyscanner.
Are we talking hundreds or over 1,000?
No, it's not over that. It's not Jamaica. Come on. It's probably, I think I paid like 650. Something like that. And they have gone up, actually. They used to only be about 450 only, but yeah.
Uganda Tourist Board should be paying us for this, shouldn't they?
Do you reckon?
Sort of giving them a bit of PR. Yeah, well, maybe not all the bad stuff we're talking about as well. But that's why I'm happy that you've talked...
Yeah, it kind of balances it out.
Yes. I'm happy you've talked about how nice people are there as well. Because I the last thing I would want is for people to hear this and go, what's this place? Kampala, Uganda. Oh, horrible. Because every society has awful, awful things in it. You know, that's, and it's, I imagine it's a rarity, right? What the child sacrifice stuff there.
Depends who you ask. But generally speaking, it's a, I can't bloody well call it a safe country now, can I? Because if you're a child, then then it's not, all of the time, depending on where you are. But there's a lot to see, a lot to do, and it's a wonderful, affordable, beautiful city, Kampala, and I encourage anyone to go.
I thought of another word instead of activism, but I don't know if this sounds quasi-religious though, but has this become a calling for you?
I think it has to have been, right? Like, I just shut down everything else in my life and was just like, hell for leather, went for this. And I have definitely described this in the past as my calling. Just because I was a bit wayward before. I knew, like, the only two things I think I've been sure about in my life are the fact that I wanted to get into TV, I wanted to be a video editor, and I wanted to pursue this. And yeah, I just felt like both of those, I wouldn't say telly is my calling, but it was certainly something that I was hell-bent on doing. And this has been no different.
Would you write a book about this? Because I can see it being turned into a movie or something, particularly about your impact and what you did there.
Don't know. Feels a bit
something to think about.
Wanky, considering that, doesn't it? Can you imagine? How would you answer that? Like, if somebody were to say, your podcasts are so interesting, like, I could see this being turned into a movie one day. What do you think? If you say yes, you're a dick. If you say no, you're being disingenuous.
Oh, no. So you mean, so yes. So the genuine answer is yes.
Of course.
You would love to.
Of course, because, yeah. I mean, it would be such an amazing story. Like, the things without, and I'm really not being arrogant, the things I've seen and heard, are like ridiculous. But at the same time, I certainly wouldn't pursue something like that. I wouldn't go actively looking for that, that opportunity. No, let things happen as they.
I think it's possible though. It's possible to do something that you do because it's worth doing, because it spreads the message more, because you're writing a book and it's a good process. And if also, like, cool things come from that, if also money comes from that, well, who cares? Like, that's, you know, you can do what you want. You can give all that money to charity if it makes you feel better, but it's still the process of writing it and getting it out there would really be something.
Yeah. Do you know, I thought when I got back, I started writing. When I got back last year, past last May, I got back and I was like, I have to start writing because this is insane and I will forget all of it if I don't. And I did. And I started thinking, could this potentially be a book? And I was just like, I can't be. Do you know how long it takes to write a book?
I'm writing one now.
No, you're not. A fiction, yeah, or hell. That is insane. What's it about?
A non-fiction. Yeah, it's not. Well, I don't know. I think contractually, I don't have a clue, but they won't mind. I hope about the psychology of secrets. So it's a lot of the stories of people I've spoken to, who, because they've all kept secrets, and what secrets has done to them all differently, and what the sort of psychology behind all that is.
Very, very cool and very, very deep. It sounds super intense. How are you finding the time? Sort of suddenly turned to me being the interviewer.
Yeah. Well, no, please do. I love being asked questions. That's my ego.
Well, I doubt you ever are, given your job, right? I don't know. Are you asked enough questions, Andrew?
No. I can't remember who it was now. I wish I could, but I remember somebody saying one time, once we'd started recording, and I'd asked them something and they asked me something back, and it was just like, how are you doing? And it suddenly went, thank you.
Sorry,
not that people are expected to do that, but I go on other people's podcasts, and that's the deal. You know, sometimes I'll go on theirs and they'll come on mine, and it's so funny how naturally it changes from, like, you know, I'm the inquisitor now, so I will hardly speak and I'll just prod now, and then as soon as I'm on theirs, that role reversal happens.
Yeah,
that's the job.
Well, okay, when is this book, plug yourself, when is this book being being released?
I'm hopefully finishing it by next May or June or something, and then I think it takes another sort of 6, 7, 8 months to for them to publish it or whatever. It's frustratingly slow, actually, because I want to just get it done. At the same time, in terms of finding the time, yeah, it's impossible. Like, I've not written a word for about 6 weeks now, and I'm just waiting for that moment where it's like, okay, I've got some time. And, like, it's not just the time, you need to be in a really specific mood, don't you,
absolutely,
to sit down and write.
Absolutely. Yeah. I remember, I know we're digressing, I wrote a tried to write a sitcom. I just took it upon myself to, I had this idea and I had to, I was living in Shoreditch at the time, in Hoxton. And I found the only place that I could write was this little Starbucks. A Starbucks, in fact, wasn't that little. Starbucks outside Ealing Tube. And I would travel. It was the only place that I found that I could actually be creative. It was really weird and really annoying and really expensive because I couldn't write at home. Well, it was just coffee. I was constantly high. So yeah, feel your pain. So for that reason, no, I'm not about that. I'll write something for myself.
I think you could see how it goes because I don't know. I mean, it might be like you know what you've got to do. You, what am I Cheers. Giving you, telling you what to do? You got to do you. I just think of one of my favorite ever movies was The Constant Gardener. It's a very different film.
That with Ralph Fiennes.
Yeah, I love that. I love that man.
Yeah. He's amazing. Like Voldemort.
I've got like a man crush on him.
Why not?
Yeah, Voldemort.
He's amazing. I'm a massive Harry Potter fan. Massive.
Me too.
Are you?
Me too.
Okay.
Yeah, I've read them all in like different languages. That was what I to learn different languages. I read Harry Potter in 5 languages.
What do you speak?
French, Spanish, German, Portuguese, and English.
Oh my God, you're amazing. How?
Yeah, this is about me. This is all about me.
This is great. This is insane. Are you? Can I just last question? Are your family Italian? So you just took it upon yourself to just learn 5 languages.
Well, in my 20s, I've paid Annie to ask these questions. In my 20s, I lived in Argentina for like 6 years, in Colombia, and then I lived in where else? Like Brazil and Germany for some time, just because. And I love Harry Potter, so I wanted to use Harry Potter to learn the languages.
You're but such
I
also I wanted to be sort of.
I am a show off. You have to, don't you? What's the point in learning 5 languages if you can't show off about it during an episode about very sad other things? Yeah. But you know, it's I wanted to be the sort of the next Louis Theroux, right? And I thought, what can I do that Louis Theroux can't? And I thought, oh, I can actually, if I go and learn these languages in my 20s, then I'll have that, and that's what he doesn't have.
You're incredible. How's that working out for you?
But it didn't work out.
No, okay. Yeah, it's time.
Well, I've got. Did you see my film about exorcism?
I did half of it. Sorry, I didn't watch it all.
Just the good half.
It's a bit triggering. Just a bit triggering. The first half. I find all of that stuff. Do you know? I used to ask my dad when I was younger to tell me all about. I love this stuff, and I like being scared, especially as a child. But now it actually terrifies me. And I think it's probably because of the work that I've done. And I wholeheartedly believe in that stuff. So I just can't go meddling with it or even watching that stuff.
Well, there's also, I mean, people, as you get older, I'm sure listeners will relate to this. You know, you probably used to, if you flew on a plane when you were a child, you probably didn't care that much. And then when you get older, you start to get a bit scared.
100%.
Just everything scares you a bit more as you get older because you realize what could happen. You know?
Yeah, it's true. I'm not as gutsy and ballsy as I was. So much so that this trip that I keep sort of bragging about next month to Uganda, I'm umming and ahhing because there's been an outbreak of Ebola. So like 3 years ago, I'd have just been like, give a shit. Like I'm going, but I'm like, should I? It's not reached Kampala yet. So I think we'll probably be all right. But yeah, this sense of kind of, I don't know, I'm not going to live forever. You know, I'm not, it's scary. It's clearly to do with age, getting older and what you've seen and what you hope to be able to do in the years to come. And I don't want anything to sort of stop that. So I think there's this, yeah. How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
33. How old are you?
I'm 37 and a half.
You look younger.
Liar.
No, you do. Well, I don't know. I've got that thing where I assume that everybody's the same age as me. Do you know what I mean?
Well, do you know, there's something nice about doing these sorts of podcasts because there's like a sort of a natural, instant, automatic filter. So it just sort of airbrushes you completely out. So there are no lines or anything like that. Fantastic. You're particularly pixelated.
No, it is good. That's why people probably don't realize how ugly I am, but on the video I look all right. It's all you know, you can't see all the marks and things. Right, we better get back on to the topic at hand. You know what you were just saying about that. I think the reason that I've done some podcasts before about why we like scary things, And a lot of it is apparently to do with our evolutionary psychology, that if you watch horrible things happening, horrible, horrible, horrible things, it might help you to practice and to know what to avoid yourself. You know, you see someone getting eaten or killed in the wild or whatever, by watching it, it gives you dopamine in your brain or something. It makes you want to watch it, and then you know how to avoid that. It's that kind of thing. And that's probably why we like public executions and public hangings and stuff back in the day. Do you think there's anything to that in the child sacrifice? I mean, is there ever like a group of witnesses watching?
What do you mean? Sort of, okay. Is it a spectator?
Like a public
thing?
Yeah.
Absolutely not. No.
Okay.
No.
This is completely
very private
hidden.
And yeah. Absolutely secretive and secluded and yeah, behind walls. Or within bushes. Yeah, no, absolutely not.
Do you think it might also just speak to humans? I mean, what does it say to you about humans? Are we naturally violent? Are we suppressing our violence and then using excuses sometimes to be violent?
I don't think it's as deep as that, if I'm honest. I think that this is a business. I think that there are those who are not just in Uganda, but various different countries in Africa and in India too, who have realized that there is big, big money in convincing people that sacrificing a child will make them rich. Especially in Uganda, it's big business. So I don't really think it's a case of, you know, going back to sort of human, you know, these sort of barbaric, it's not a case, I think it's bigger than violence. I don't think that that's as prominent in this situation as really unscrupulous, evil people realizing that they can capitalize off people's desperation.
And where is the money in all of this? Because obviously we've got what's happening is, you know, because for prosperity and luck and things. So where does what's with the money here?
So obviously, a witch doctor is paid for their services, and the ultimate, you know, one of the most expensive things to ask a witch doctor to do or provide for you is the sacrifice of a child. So this can cost anywhere from about £200, which isn't very much to us, but is a huge amount to a particular witch doctor, and can rise to thousands and thousands. So children are murdered for money. And, you know, it's not just the witch doctor who are paid. Obviously, it's the person who abducts the child. It's the person who goes out to buy the utensils to cut the child. It's such a network. You've got the driver, you've got the person who obtains the phones to make, you know, to communicate with those involved. So yes, it's a very, very profitable business.
Is it like a mafia? And are there famous witch doctors? I suppose because it's so illegal, they've got to hide, I guess.
But you've got to be quite careful when you kind of, there are witch doctors and traditional healers, right? Witch doctors are those who are carrying out witchcraft and appeasing ancestral spirits, not necessarily carrying out child sacrifice, but it's the witch doctors who are carrying out child sacrifice, amongst other things. And then you've got traditional healers who are, you know, medicine men and women, and they use traditional herbs to cure ailments and illnesses, and they're very reputable. So sometimes, that those lines are blurred, and the traditional healers, especially in Uganda, get a really bad name for themselves because of the reputation of witch doctors who are carrying out these, hideous acts.
And then was this, when you got there, was this legal?
No. So it's always been illegal to sacrifice a child, murder a child. But the issue was that defendants were being charged using the penal code, which did not carry an adequate sentence, in my opinion. And there were significant loopholes in not just the penal code, but the Anti-Trafficking in Persons Act that made it really, really easy for people who are carrying out this crime to be let off. For example, you know, if there was a case of a child who was kept in a shrine and she was gradually sacrificed, and instead of just, you know, removing her body parts and leaving her to die, she was born for the purpose of sacrifice. So over the years, she was, you know, they would remove a fingernail, it would grow back, and they'd remove it again. They'd remove her earlobes, teeth, pull out hair. By the time I met her, she couldn't hear, she couldn't see, she couldn't speak. She was in a wheelchair. It's awful. So the guys who did that to her were charged with kidnap and torture, and were given a ridiculously low sentence. So our law has that provision of gradual sacrifice, and it carries a really, really high sentence. So we have thought of every single possible scenario that is involved in sacrificing a child, from the moment that call is made to the murder of that child, and every single stage has a crime attached to it. We have spent so long thinking of every possible scenario to make sure that there aren't any loopholes anymore.
Yeah, so what kind of things were they like? So now, placing a call, that is a crime that will get you a sentence, placing a call to a witch doctor about child sacrifice.
Yes, and it's obviously at the judge's discretion. But I know that the law has been used a few times now, which I'm insanely proud of. Yes, one of them, I think I briefly mentioned about this little boy who survived, and he could identify his attackers earlier. I mentioned there were some cases of that happening, and this little boy, finally, his perpetrators were caught, and they were sentenced to, I think it was 44 years, which I know doesn't sound very much, but we will appeal that. He ain't getting out. But he had been, this poor little boy has been living with, they removed his penis, they castrated him, and tried to cut his head off. So he's got this huge scar here. He went to Australia for surgery, funded by a charity, and they did what they could. But he was living in the same community as the man who attacked him, and he couldn't do anything because at the time, a child's eyewitness account was not enough to secure a conviction. So this guy's now behind bars, and I am really thrilled to see that this boy has justice, and that this bill, this law, I've got to get used to calling it law, is being used in the way that it was designed to. I'm insanely proud of it.
I'm amazed. I am. And I don't want to compliment you too much, because I don't think you don't want it, but I'm amazed by what you've done. I really am. It's funny how that's come about as well, because that, you know, the Puritans with the witches, the problem was children's eyewitness accounts was putting people into prison. But this is a completely different spin on it. It's like, this is a really, really good thing.
It's a very good thing. And I have to say, it really is not just me who has pushed this through at all. After a few years, I got funding from an incredible UK-based charity called Children on the Edge. And without their help, I certainly wouldn't have been able to consider being anywhere near here. Like they helped finance this. They did finance it, sorry. Offered emotional support, everything. It was just, it's impossible to imagine having done this without them. So, and also my team in Uganda as well. So this is not just me. I want to make that really, really clear. Yeah. I couldn't think about it. It would be impossible to try and take on a mountain like that. I needed help, and help I had.
What were some of the challenges you faced in trying to change this law?
So we didn't change it. We introduced a specific law. And the challenges were just that, actually. That was one of the main ones that, you know, we came up against so much sort of criticism, like we don't need a new law. We've got the Anti-Trafficking in Persons Act. We've got the Penal Code. This is perfectly adequate. No, they really aren't, which is why people are getting off left, right and center. Financing. I financed it myself for the first 3 years. So I was working in London, save up money, come back to Uganda and mobilize MPs. I was very whimsical with the way that I was going about it. Not particularly methodical, right? But I didn't really know what I was doing. But it became very, very clear that I needed funding, and I contacted Children on the Edge, and Rachel Bentley, one of the founders, just took a chance on me. And I'm forever, forever grateful for their support. So money was a big one. I think, you know, often like maintaining that sort of momentum, because 7 years is no joke, you know, it was very much like that. And often I thought, what am I doing? I want to go back to London and party and just do nothing. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to do a whole heap of nothing and just forget that this had happened. Because actually, I remember feeling like this is a bloody curse. Because like in the midst of it, you can't walk away once you know something like that's happening. So I felt totally anchored to this.
You were stuck to it. But then you got the bill passed with 2 minutes to spare.
Yes. Not 2 minutes. Not 2 minutes. 2 days. 2 days okay. To spare. Yeah. So the Ugandan parliament was reaching, there was going to be a new parliament basically. And, the end of the 10th parliament was ending on the Friday, and Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, 3 days to spare. And yeah, we presented on the Tuesday. Astonishingly, somehow were able to get a slot, because we were actually told previously it wasn't going to happen. And I got a call in the morning from my colleague in Parliament. It was like, we're presenting this bill at 10 o'clock. And it was like 9 a.m. And I rushed like a bat out of hell to Parliament in a really, really, really inappropriate jumpsuit. And I jumped on the back of a Boda Boda, which is a motorcycle taxi. And told the guy to just get there as soon as possible. Got to Parliament and met the MP who was presenting the bill. And he was like, well, you can't enter Parliament like that. You can't. Like, you look. I was like, no, this can't happen. I can't not see this happen and pass or fail. I just couldn't let that happen. And somehow I managed to get a friend to bodder me some clothes, and I changed in one of the offices, and yeah, was able to watch it. That would have broken my heart if I wasn't able to watch that. All because of a fashion faux pas. Could you imagine living that down?
It would have been ridiculous. These kinds of things.
But I should have, no, but I've been in and out of Parliament for a long, like I should have known that, you know, some spotty hipster kind of, no, it wasn't appropriate. But yeah, no, I remember the moment it passed. It was just something that I will gladly hold on to forever. It was a very, very long process. It was raining, and because of COVID, it was in this like outdoor tent, and there were mosquitoes everywhere. And it just went on for something like 2.5 hours, because I was going through loads of other bills, and finally it got to ours, and there was like a moment where they were disputing one of the clauses. I was like, oh God, it's not going to happen. And then, finally it did.
Did you feel emotional in the moment that it passed?
Yeah, embarrassingly so. You know, Ugandans are really conservative, but so emotion and tears and all of that just doesn't really fly, not in a professional setting. And the colleague in Parliament who had rang me in the morning had been there from day one. In fact, he was the legislator who offered to help me for free. And so he was sitting to my left, and he'd never seen me you know, break down like that. And it was him who'd sort of turned to me and said it had passed. And oh gosh, I get emotional thinking about that because, you know, we sort of started it together and we ended it together. And yeah, it was just a really, really special moment.
Well, you saved a lot of lives. I mean, you did more in that moment or in those years than most of us do with our lives.
I don't really know what to say to that. I'm just glad it's being used. You know, like there was a moment maybe like 6 months ago where implementation is a really big part of this. Like Uganda has got lots of laws, but unless they're really implemented, they don't really do anything. And there was a moment a while back that I was like, this is just not being used, this bill. Like, have we done all of this for nothing? And then slowly and surely it started getting used, like the case that I've just told you about. So, yeah. I had a new
renewed.
Kind of,
sorry. You go. Sorry. I try and cut in.
You go. No, I'm sick of talking now.
I want a break. The thing about doing this online is I always have to try and anticipate when someone's about to finish. So because of
just
the slight
delay. Just
put
your hand up. Just put your hand up and I'll stop.
But I don't want you to stop. I only want you to stop if you've actually finished. But I always have to interpret that it looks like they may be finished. But if they are going to just leave a gap and then they've got more to say, I don't want to stop it.
Right. I'll put my hand up when I'm finishing, right? Like about two or three words before the end of a sentence. Will that help you out? Yeah.
It might look weird though on YouTube. That's the thing. You always put your hand up. Do you think this will stop more of child sacrifice through prevention? You know, people know that there's going to be a higher sentence, or maybe locking up the offenders so there are fewer of them at large.
I think it will do. It depends. It depends what the future of this law is, really, and if it continues to be used in the way that it's being used. I think that it will undoubtedly work as a deterrent, but I don't think it will do much more than that. I think what's really, really important is this stage two, which is what I'm doing now, is working on implementation, training up the judiciary so that you know exactly how to use this law. Working at the grassroots level to try and convince and educate communities without sounding really wanky and condescending that this is not the way to go and that there are other ways in which to prosper. They have to work in conjunction. And I feel as though I picked the easy one of the two. Passing a law is like, you know, but convincing, you know, a community where, you know, within the whole fabrics of their being is that, you know, you have to appease the ancestral spirits in order to X, Y, and Z. It's going to be really, really hard and probably won't be achieved in my lifetime. But they have to work in conjunction. The bill alone will do very, very little, I'm afraid to say. It will do some, and the sum is more than enough for me. But I just feel like while I've got the energy and the means and the momentum, I'd just like to continue in this field.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
There's a weirdness. Do you ever cross your, just so people listening know, Annie put her hand up to say she finished. There's a weird thing here where it is a case of like wealthier Western people going over. I mean, you mentioned educate, which I was going to ask you next. How do we educate people not to do it? But it's just occurred to me, there is that thing of like us going over and we're going to educate you on how to be. At the same time, the thing that's happening by our standards just seems so abhorrent that it seems crazy not to try and do that, right?
Yeah. Yes. I think it helps that I'm not white. I think I'd have a hard time. I'm still called Mzungu over there, which is white person, because I'm fairer than them, most people. So I still get a tough time. In fact, I'm probably seen as white. In fact, I am, but I think they wouldn't admit it, but I think that they're more susceptible to maybe listening to some of my ideas than they might do if maybe you went sure. over, you know?
Sure.
So I've got that up my sleeve, but that's about it. That is about
it. Is it weird? Is it weird feeling white there?
Yeah, I don't like it. No offense. I don't, because I'm not. It's taking away my blackness, like, and my identity. So yeah, it's not nice. It's annoying, but I got used to it. But to be called Mzungu all the time, right? Which is you, white person. It's just like, come on. I learned the word for mixed race, but and we just would shout it back, but Muchutala, that's it, Muchutala, but it just didn't really stick.
Yeah, I got caught when I was in Argentina, in South America. I was gringo, obviously, all the time.
Oh, yeah,
gringo,
yeah.
This, gringo that, yeah. which it was annoying again, because that's an American. That's supposed to be American. I had to. I'm not them. I'm not Yankee, as they would say. You know.
No. But.
Go on, what were you gonna say?
No, I wasn't actually, I was just filling the silence.
Are there still places in other parts of Africa or other parts of the world that you know of where this goes on?
Yes, Botswana, Nigeria, parts of Ghana, and India is specific, like particularly bad. There was a moment last year where I felt really galvanized, and there's an organization who helped us, kind of helped inform us when it came to the bill and writing legislation, because in legislation, what legislators borrow from other existing laws to create their own provisions. It's above board. It sounds really kind of cagey, like they're plagiarizing. They're not. And we borrowed a lot from the existing laws in India that outlaw this practice. And I got talking to a charity over there who are really keen to introduce specific legislation on this. And I just learned I thought Uganda was bad, but India has a real serious problem. Not all over. And don't ask me where, I can't quite remember. But I thought perhaps I could then sort of take the, you know, law and the team that I'd worked with over there and start helping them, but I don't have the time. No, can't.
It's too much for one person.
It is, yeah. I feel bad saying that.
What was the I forgot to ask you about the boy who was lured to buy soap by his uncle.
Yeah, what about him?
What was his story?
So there are two twin boys, brothers, who were at home one day, and their uncle asked them to come to the shop with him and told them that they were off to buy soap, and he took them into the bush and sat one of them down and sacrificed the other one in front of his brother. He cut off his head and removed his genitals, and was just left to die. While his brother watched on completely helpless. That happens all the time, by the way. It's not uncommon. It's horrible. However, not uncommon. The issue with one of the many issues with this is that the uncle was found by the mob justice before the police could really get to him, and he was burnt alive, and they took it into their own hands to deal with him as they saw fit. His brother, so the boy is now 12 and he's doing very well. He's in school. I spoke to him literally a couple of weeks ago. So he's got the support around him, I think, that he needs. And he's doing, all things considered, well, I think.
That's amazing to hear. And but horrific what he went through, and horrible. And I guess that's, you know, a place to sort of come to an end and ask, like, is there much that listeners can do to help or to find out more, you know?
That is a good question. Do you know what? There's not enough out there on... When I was trying to research this, the first article I put in child sacrifice, Uganda, and there was this, you know, the first article I read was this Daily Mail. Horrible, sensational, no offense to Daily Mail listeners or, you know, workers, but it just was completely inaccurate. It was just awful. So many holes. There's not enough information out there, which I am working on. But I think there's always funding that needs to be. I don't want to ask for money. I'm not going to do that. But if you would like to help, I am, you know, introducing this second phase where implementation is so important. I have set up a GoFundMe page, which I cannot believe has done so well. Every day I seem to get a little a donation, and I think it's unbelievable. There's no pressure whatsoever to donate. Do if you want, don't worry if you don't, but there's that. And I think I'm just working on a way to make this information accessible to people, not just through the means of podcasts, and just because I think it's really important that people know what's going on in their world.
Well, I am going to pressure people to give their money to you, to contribute to your GoFundMe.
Nice. Thank you.
That's me doing it. Everyone, yeah, do go check. What, just Annie Iqba GoFundMe?
I don't know. I think so. I can't. The Children on the Edge set it up. This is how I don't know. Can I tell you? Could you link to it maybe?
Yeah. I mean, anyone who does, it's wonderful of you. I mean, typically a lot of listeners buy the book of one of my guests, you know, so I think if they spent the equivalent on paying towards this, and this is paying towards helping you go out and, you know, change things out there and hopefully save some lives. So Annie, thank you for being on The Edge. What a fantastic guest you've been. Thank you.
It's been really, really good. I think, thank you for giving me the platform to talk about something that's really important to me and that should be spoken about way more often. Thank you.
Thank you, Annie, so much for your patience and kindness during our recording, and I think I thank her on behalf of all humanity for her determination in bringing about change in a place where child sacrifice was rife. Remember to find out more about her work on Children on the Edge, a pure coincidence, the title of that being close to that of this podcast, and check out her video on Lad Bible about bringing about a change in the law around child sacrifice. That's all for now. Coming up are episodes with a psychopath, a former evangelist, and Robbie Williams Part 2. See you soon.